He thought it could, provided he steered clear of a southward advance, for if we follow the enemy into the swamps of Mississippi, there can be no doubt that the army will be disabled by disease. At least one of the general's wool-clad soldiers agreed with him. After being exposed to what Halleck was now avoiding, an Indiana veteran declared, "You load a man down with a 60-pound knapsack, his gun, and 40 rounds of ammunition, a haversack full of hardtack and sow belly, and a 3-pint canteen full of water. Then start him along this narrow roadway with the mercury up to 100, and the dust so thick you could taste it, and you have done the next thing to killing this man outright." "And yet," Halleck wrote, "to lie still, doing nothing, will not be satisfactory to the country nor conducive to the health of the army." He had therefore deemed it best to do as he had done. There was one drawback, one calculated risk. "This plan is based on the supposition that the enemy will not attempt an active campaign during the summer months. Should he do so, the present dispositions must be varied to suit the change of circumstances." One immediate result the shake-up had: George Thomas returned to his old division, which was stationed under Halleck's eye at Corinth, and Grant was restored to the command of his old Army of the Tennessee, which included the divisions under Sherman and McClernand. Receiving permission to establish headquarters at Memphis, he set out on June 21st with a dozen troopers as escort, and after narrowly escaping capture on the way, Confederate horsemen, tipped off that he was coming, missed intercepting him by less than an hour, arrived 3 days later to find affairs in rather bad order, secessionists governing much in their own way. He reported that there was even a plot to burn the city, which he thought might prove partially successful, though he believed that such an action would operate more against the rebels than ourselves. The main thing he needed, he told Halleck, was more troops. Old Brains was in no mood just now to give him anything but trouble. By the end of June, they had renewed their old-time wrangle. Halleck began it, wiring, "You say 30,000 men are at Shelbyville to attack LaGrange. Where is Shelbyville? I can't find it on any map. Don't believe a word about an attack in large force on LaGrange or Memphis. Why not send out a strong reconnaissance and ascertain the facts? It looks very much like a mere stampede. Floating rumors must never be received as facts. I mean to make somebody responsible for so gross a negligence." Grant replied, "I did not say 30,000 troops at Shelbyville, but at Abbeville, which is south of Holly Springs on the road to Grenada." Then he too got his back up. "I heed as little of floating rumors about this city as anyone," he protested. He had asked for more troops, he said, "that I might do effectively what you now ask. Stampeding is not my weakness. On the contrary, I will always execute any order to the best of my ability with the means at hand." Halleck drew in his horns at this, replying 4 days later, "I made no insinuation that there had been the slightest neglect on your part, nor did I suppose for a moment that you were stampeded, for I know that is not in your nature." Then, as if he had leaned down to stroke old Rover, only to have old Rover snap at his hand, he added, "I must confess that I was very much surprised at the tone of your dispatch and the ill feeling manifested in it, so contrary to your usual style, and especially toward one who has so often befriended you when you were attacked by others." This was more or less the note on which the other hassle had ended 4 months back. Grant was willing to let it go at that. But 5 days later, July 8th, Halleck was at him again. "The Cincinnati Gazette contains the substance of your demanding reinforcements and my refusing them. You either have a newspaper correspondent on your staff, or your staff is very leaky." 3 days later, the Memphis telegraph receiver clacked off a blunt 1 dozen words from Corinth. "You will immediately repair to this place and report to these headquarters." Just what have I done now? Grant must have thought. It was not his way to worry, but he apparently had cause. For the past 2 weeks, and indeed before, Halleck had shown all the earmarks of a commander engaged in the old army game of needling an unwanted subordinate enough to keep him edgy and fatten the record against him, but of holding back from the big pounce until something downright ruinous turned up to head the list of charges and specifications. Whether his sin was one of omission or commission, Grant did not know, though he had 3 full days for wondering while his horse retraced the steps taken 3 weeks ago, with its head in the opposite direction. At last, July 15th, the worried general reached Corinth and was face to face with his tormentor. What he was confronted with, however, was not the climax to a series of well-organized reproaches, but rather the accomplishment of the happy accident Sherman had persuaded him to wait for. Halleck was ordered to Washington to take over the direction of all the armies east and west, and Grant was to receive, by seniority, the lion's share of what he left behind. Specifically, this included command of 2 armies, his own, now under McClernand and Sherman, and Pope's, now under Rosecrans, and of the department embracing North Mississippi, West Tennessee, and Kentucky west of the Cumberland River. He had what he wanted, but not as he preferred it. The fact was, he disapproved of nearly all that had been done since Halleck's arrival from St. Louis, later saying, "For myself, I am satisfied Corinth could have been captured in a 2 days' campaign commenced promptly on the arrival of reinforcements after the Battle of Shiloh." Most of all, he disapproved of what had been done, or left undone, since Beauregard's sly evacuation of Corinth. With the Mississippi in Union hands, northward above Baton Rouge and southward below Memphis, the Confederates at the west were narrowed down for all communication with Richmond to the single line of road running east from Vicksburg. That was the true goal now, that city, that stretch of river, that railroad. To dispossess them of this would be equal to the amputation of a limb and its weakening effects. As he saw it, after the capture of Corinth, a movable force of 80,000 men, besides enough to hold all the territory acquired, could have been set in motion for the accomplishment of this great campaign for the suppression of the rebellion. Thus Grant, by hindsight, but Halleck could not see it, or else he feared to undertake it, and the work of depletion commenced. Even so, when he wound up his paperwork and departed for Washington 2 days later, he left his successor in immediate command of more than the 80,000 troops, which Grant afterwards said would have been enough for the taking of Vicksburg that summer. The trouble was, they were far from movable except when they were needed as reinforcements in adjoining departments. Before he had been at his post a week, he was ordered to send a division to strengthen Samuel Curtis, who had marched from northwest Arkansas to Helena, where the St. Francis River flowed into the Mississippi, 50 airline miles below Memphis. Still, this left Grant with well over 75,000 effectives. Sherman had 16,000 at Memphis, and McClernand had 10,000 around Jackson. Another 7,500 were stationed at Columbus, Cairo, and Paducah, while the rest of the Army of the Tennessee, 12,000 men under Major General E.O.C. Ord, a West Point classmate of Halleck's just arrived from Virginia, were at Corinth. Rosecrans's Army of the Mississippi, 32,000 strong, was spread along a 35-mile front that extended from south of Corinth to Cherokee, Alabama. It was a sizable force, but deep in enemy country as he was, charged with the consolidation of all that had been gained since Donelson and Shiloh, Grant found that its very size increased his major immediate problem, which was how to keep it fed and equipped. Just as the foregoing spring had set records for rainfall, so now the summer was breaking records for drought, and as a result the Tennessee River was all but worthless as a supply line. So was the Memphis and Charleston Railroad, for the rebels had torn up the track between Chihuahua and Grand Junction, and west of there the line had had to be abandoned for lack of rolling stock. All that was left him, except in Memphis, which of course could be supplied by river — the Mississippi never got really thirsty — was the slender thread of the Mobile and Ohio, stretching back to Columbus across more than 100 miles of guerrilla-infested West Tennessee, vulnerable throughout its length to attack by bands of regular and irregular cavalry, equally skilled at burning bridges and wrecking culverts, of which there were many. Tactically, too, the problems were not simple. Principal among them was the presence in North Mississippi of a highly mobile Confederate force, reckoned at 35,000 men, under the command of the resourceful and diabolical Earl Van Dorn, who sooner or later was probably going to succeed in one of his hair-trigger schemes. Its strength was less than half Grant's own, but its advantages were large. Van Dorn, for example, did not have to post a single man on guard in his rear, and best of all, or worst, he could choose the point of attack. He could strike the unconnected extremities, Corinth at one end, Memphis at the other, or he could pierce the lightly held center and knife straight through for Bolivar, Jackson, or Brownsville. What was more, he could choose the time. Grant did not look forward to the coming months. Committed as he was to the defensive, much as he had been while biding his time before Shiloh, this was still not his kind of war. It was true he had learned from what had happened then. From now on, he would keep in close touch with his field commanders and see to it that they had their men in trench. But he still did not like it, and he declared long afterwards that these midsummer months had been for him the most anxious period of the war. Discontent was general, amphibious, so to speak. For the Navy, too, the successes of late spring and early summer, up and down the Falling River, north and south of Vicksburg, were followed by a hot weather season of doubts and tribulations. Every victory was accompanied by a setback, and the fruits thereof were bitter, their savor turning to ashes in the mouth. For Flag Officers Farragut and Davis, as for Grant, the midsummer word was anxious. Davis ran into trouble first. As if Plum Run Bend had not been proof enough that his ironclads were vulnerable, it was presently reproved in Backwoods, Arkansas, and on one of the resurrected victims of that earlier disaster. In the course of his eastward march from Pea Ridge to Helena, Curtis had to cross White River, a task that was complicated by the presence of a Confederate fort at St. Charles, 60 miles from the mouth. Given orders to reduce it immediately after his Memphis triumph, Davis assigned the mission to 4 gunboats and an Indiana regiment which went along in transports. Raised, pumped out, and patched, the Mound City had the flag. This was her first outing since her encounter with the Van Dorn back in May. When the flotilla came within sight of the fort, June 17th, the Hoosier colonel requested permission to assault by land. There were only just over 100 rebels in the place. But the naval commander refused to yield or even share the honors. Closing with the flagship, he opened fire at point-blank range, whereupon the fort replied with a 42-pound solid that pierced the Mound City's casemate and went right through her steam drum, scalding to death or drowning 125 out of her crew of 175 men, injuring 25 more and leaving only 25 unhurt. It was freakish in more ways than one, including arithmetically, for the round-looking casualty figures were exact. Helpless, the ironclad went with the current and the other gunboats withdrew, leaving the proposed reduction to the Indianians, who encircled the fort and took it without the loss of a man. Davis had himself another victory, though he had it at far from a bargain price, and the credit went to the army. Farragut's troubles downriver were at once less bloody and more personal, and having a slop jar emptied onto his head from a French Quarter window was only the least of them. 5 days after congratulating him for his magnificent execution and unparalleled achievements at New Orleans, Assistant Secretary Fox heard that the Tennessee sailor had abandoned the attempt against Vicksburg. "Impossible!" Fox cried. "Sending the fleet up to meet Commodore Davis was the most important part of the whole expedition. The instructions were positive." Quickly, he reiterated them in triplicate, dispatching the original and two copies in three different ships to make certain of delivery. "It is of paramount importance that you go up and clear the river with utmost expedition. Mobile, Pensacola, and in fact the whole coast, sinks into insignificance compared with this." 2 days later, he repeated the admonition in a second dispatch, invoking the support of higher authority. "The President requires you to use your utmost exertions, without a moment's delay and before any other naval operation shall be permitted to interfere, to open the Mississippi and effect a junction with Flag Officer Davis." On his previous trip upriver, Farragut had explained it to Butler why he did not think a limited expedition against Vicksburg should be undertaken. "As they have so large a force of soldiers here, several thousand in and about the town, and the facility of bringing in 20,000 in an hour by railroad from Jackson, altogether, I think it would be useless to bombard it, as we could not hold it if we take it." He still felt that way about it, but the orders from Fox, which presently arrived, left him no choice. He put the fleet in order for the 400-mile ascent, taking part of Porter's mortar flotilla with him this time, as well as 3,000 men from Butler, and came within sight of Vicksburg's red clay bluff on the same day the Mound City took the Solid through her boiler. He was back again, and though he still did not like the task before him, he wrote home that he was putting his trust in the Lord. "If it is his pleasure to take me, may he protect my wife and boy from the rigors of a wicked world." He spent 10 days re-examining the problem and giving the mortars time to establish ranges. Then, on the night of June 27th, he made his run. 11 warships were in the 117-gun column, 3 heavy sloops, 2 light sloops, and 6 gunboats. Skippers of the 8 smaller vessels were instructed to hug the western bank, while the large ones took the middle, the Richmond leading because her chase guns were situated best for high-angle fire, then the flagship Hartford and finally the Brooklyn, lending a heavy sting to the tail. 2 hours after midnight, the attack signal was hoisted, and for the next 3 hours it was New Orleans all over again. Except that this time the rebel gunners, high on their 200-foot bluff, were taking little punishment in return. Down on the river, by contrast, everything was smoke and uproar. The Brooklyn and 2 of the gunboats were knocked back, and all of the others were hit repeatedly. Total casualties were 15 killed and 30 wounded, but when daylight came, 8 of the ships were beyond the hairpin turn, and Farragut was farther from salt water than he had been since he first left Tennessee to join the Navy more than 50 years before. 2 days later, July 1st, Davis brought his gunboats down from Memphis, and the two fleets were joined. There was much visiting back and forth, much splicing of the main brace, and with cause. Upper and nether millstones had come together at last, and now there was not even grist between them. There, precisely, was the trouble, for now that Farragut was up here, there was nothing left for him to do. The day before the Blue Water ships steamed past the batteries, Colonel A.W. Ellet, his brother's successor, took 2 of his rams up the Yazoo River, which emptied into the Mississippi a dozen miles above Vicksburg, to investigate a report that the rebels had 3 gunboats lurking there. It turned out to be true, one of them being the Van Dorn, only survivor of the Memphis route, but all 3 were set afire as soon as the rams hove into view, and Ellet came back out again to report that he had destroyed the fag end of the Confederate resistance on the western rivers. Then the Gulf Squadron made its run, and the 2 fleets rode at anchor, midway between Vicksburg and the mouth of the Yazoo. As far as Farragut could see, however, all the exploit had really yielded was more proof that he could take his ships past fortifications, a fact he had never doubted in the first place. "We have done it," he informed the department, "and can do it again as often as may be required of us." Just now, though, what he mainly wanted was a breath of salt air in his lungs. Requesting permission from Washington to go back downriver again, he emphasized the point that there were now 2 fleets biding their time in an area where there was not even work enough for 1. While awaiting an answer, he did what he could to keep his sailors busy, including having them fire a high noon 21-gun salute in celebration of the 4th. The 3,000 soldiers were no problem in this respect. With an ingenuity worthy of Butler himself, their commander, Brigadier General Thomas Williams, had them digging a canal across the narrow tongue of land dividing the shanks of the Hairpin Bend in front of Vicksburg. When the river rose, the general said it would widen the ditch and sluice out a passage for the fleet, beyond the range of the batteries on the bluff. But there was the rub. The river was not rising, it was falling. It was falling so fast, in fact, that Farragut had begun to fear that his deep-draft sea-going fleet would be stranded up here all summer. On July 13th, he sent a wire which he hoped would jog the department into action on his request. In 10 days, the river will be too low for the ships to go down. Shall they go down or remain up the rest of the year? One problem more there was, though he did not consider it a matter for real concern, never having had much of an ear for rumor. In addition to the 3 gunboats whose destruction Ellet had effected when he appeared up the Yazoo, there were whispers that the Confederates were building themselves an ironclad up there. Farragut did not give the rumor much credence. Even if it were true, he said, there was small chance that the rebels would ever be able to use such a craft, bottled up as she was, with 2 powerful federal fleets standing guard in the Mississippi, just below the only point of exit. "I do not think she will ever come forth," he reported. Davis was not so sure. Unlike Farragut, he had Plum Run Bend in his memory, which had taught him what havoc a surprise attack could bring. Determined not to suffer such a reverse again, he ordered 3 warships up the Yazoo to investigate and take up lookout stations. They left immediately after early breakfast, July 15th. The ironclad Carondelet, the wooden gunboat Tyler, and the steam ram Queen of the West. The rumors were all too true, as Farragut was about to discover. The mystery ship was the Arkansas, floated unfinished down the Mississippi and towed up the Yazoo to Greenwood after the fall of Island 10 exposed her to capture in Memphis. Naval Lieutenant Isaac Newton Brown, a 45-year-old Kentuckian who had held the same rank as a Veracruz veteran in the old Navy, which he had entered from Mississippi nearly 30 years ago, was given command of her in late May, together with orders to finish and equip that vessel without regard to expenditure of men or money. He did not realize what a large order this was until he got to Greenwood and saw her. Unfinished was not the word. She was scarcely even begun. The vessel was a mere hull, without armor. The engines were apart. Guns without carriages were lying about the deck. A portion of the railroad iron intended as armor was at the bottom of the river, and the other and far greater part was to be sought for in the interior of the country. So he later reported, but now he got to work. After a day spent fishing up the sunken iron, he towed the skeleton Arkansas 150 miles downriver to Yazoo City, where the facilities were better, though not much. Scouring the plantations roundabout, he set up 14 forges on the riverbank and kept them going around the clock. Rural blacksmiths pounding at the wagon loads of scrap iron brought in from all points of the compass. 200 carpenters added to the din, hammering, sawing, swarming over the shield and hull. Perhaps the biggest problem was the construction of carriages for the guns. Nothing of the sort had ever been built in Mississippi, but this too was met by letting the contract to 2 gentlemen of Jackson, who supplied them from their Canton wagon factory. Other deficiencies could not be overcome and were let go. Since there was no apparatus for bending the iron around the curve of the vessel's quarter or stern, for example, boilerplate was tacked over these parts, for appearance's sake, Brown explained. Also, the paint was bad. She was intended to be chocolate brown, the color of the river, but no matter how many coats were applied, she kept her original hue, rusty red. Despite all this, the work in the improvised yard went on. Within 5 weeks, according to one of her lieutenants, we had a man of war, such as she was, from almost nothing. By July 12th, she was as finished as she would ever be. Brown sent the mechanics ashore and dropped down to Satarsha Bar, where, as he later said, "I now gave the executive officer a day to organize and exercise his men." In the crew of about 175, two-thirds were from the recently burned gunboats. The rest were infantry volunteers, distributed among the 10 gun crews serving weapons of various calibers, three in each broadside, two forward and two aft. July 14th, the descent resumed. 15 miles below, at the mouth of the Sunflower River, the guns of the two Union fleets engaged in target practice out on the Mississippi were plainly audible from here. It was discovered that steam from the engines and boiler had penetrated the forward magazine. Brown tied up alongside a sawmill clearing, landed the wet powder, and spread it on tarpaulins to dry in the sun. "By constant shaking and turning," he reported, "we got it back to the point of ignition before the sun sank below the trees." Packing what they could of it into the after magazine, the gun crews came back aboard and the Arkansas continued on her way. Guns cast loose and men at quarters, expecting every moment to meet the enemy. At midnight, her commander called a rest halt near Haynes Bluff. Then at 3 a.m., July 15th, continued down the river. Information received from Vicksburg put the number of enemy warships at 37, and Brown intended to be among them by daylight, with every possible advantage of surprise. It was not to be. The twin-screw vessel's engines had a habit of stopping on dead center one at a time, which would throw her abruptly into bank, despite the rudder, and this was what happened now in the pre-dawn darkness. While the rest of the crew was engaged in getting her off again, a lieutenant went ashore in search of information. He came to a plantation house, but found that the residents had fled at the first sound of a steamer on the river. All that was left was one old Negro woman, and she would tell him nothing, not even the whereabouts of her people. In fact, she would not admit that they had been there in the first place. "They have but just left," the lieutenant insisted. "The beds are yet warm." "Don't know about that, and if I did, I wouldn't tell you." "Do you take me for a Yankee? Don't you see I wear a gray coat?" "Certainly you's a Yankee," the woman said. "Our folks ain't got none them gumboats." It took an hour to get the unwieldy Arkansas underway again. The lieutenant returned from his profitless excursion with time to spare. Attempting to get back on schedule, Brown called for all the speed the engines could give him, but it was by no means enough. When daylight filtered through, the ironclad was still in the Yazoo. The sun came up fiery as she entered Old River, a 10-mile lake formed by a cutoff from the Mississippi, and the lookout spotted three Union warships dead ahead, steaming upstream in line abreast, the Carondelet in the center, flanked by the Tyler and the Queen of the West. Brown made a brief speech, ending, "Go to your guns." Stripped to the waist in the early morning heat, with handkerchiefs bound about their heads to keep the sweat from trickling into their eyes, the gun crews stood to their pieces. The officers, too, had removed their coats and paced the sanded deck in their undershirts, all but Brown, who remained in full uniform, his short, tawny beard catching the breeze as he stood on the shield, directly over the bow guns, which he ordered not to fire until the action was fully joined, lest by doing so we should diminish our speed. He and the Carondelet's captain, Henry Walk, had been friends in the old Navy, messmates on a voyage around the world, and he wanted nothing to delay this first meeting since they had gone their separate ways. The Federal skippers reacted variously to their first glimpse of the rust-red vessel bearing down on them out of nowhere. The Queen of the West, unarmed and with her speed advantage canceled by the current, turned at once and frankly ran. The Carondelet and Tyler stayed on course, intending to fire their bow guns, then swing round and make a downstream fight with their stern pieces, hoping the noise would bring help from the rest of the fleet. Both fired and missed. By the time they had turned it to run for safety, the Arkansas was upon them. She chose the Carondelet, the slower of the two, pumping shells into her lightly armored stern, which aided her vitals and slowed her even more. The return shots glanced off the Arkansas's prow, doing no considerable damage except to one seaman who, more curious than prudent, stuck his head out of a gunport for a better view and had it taken off by a bolt from an 8-inch rifle. The headless body fell back on the deck, and a lieutenant, fearing the sight would demoralize the rest of the gun crew, called upon the nearest man to heave it overboard. "Oh, I can't do it, sir. It's my brother," he replied. Other casualties followed, one among them being Brown himself. Most of the shots from dead ahead struck the inclined shield and were deflected back and upwards, ricocheting. But presently one did not carry him high enough, and Brown received what he later called a severe contusion on the head. He thought he was done for until he drew a handful of clotted blood from the wound and failed to find any particles of brain mixed in. He stayed at his post, continuing to direct both the gunnery and the navigation. Just then, however, the Tyler dropped back to help the crippled Carondelet, her riflemen firing volleys at Brown, the only live target outside the shield. A Minnie struck him over the left temple, tumbling him down a hatchway and onto the forward guns. When he regained consciousness, the aid men were laying him among the dead and wounded below deck. He promptly got up and returned to his place on the shield. The Carondelet was much closer now, he saw, and so was the mouth of the river. Just as she reached it, and just as he was about to ram her stern, she veered into bank, leaking steam and frantic survivors from all her ports. Brown did not stay to complete her destruction or force her surrender. Instead, he took up pursuit of the Tyler, which by now had entered the Mississippi and was doing all she could to overtake the Queen. Aboard the fleet, the sailors had heard the firing but had assumed that the boats were shelling snipers in the woods. Now they saw better, though they still did not understand what they saw. Observing the gunboat returning with a strange red vessel close on her heels, one officer remarked, "There comes the Tyler with a prize." They soon learned better. Within range of the fleet, a forest of masts and smokestacks, Brown called it, in every direction except astern, our eyes rested on enemies. Noting that the army rams were anchored behind the bigger ships in position to dart out through the intervals, the Confederate skipper told his pilot, "Brady, shave that line of men of war as close as you can so that the rams will not have room to gather headway in coming out to strike us." Brady gave him what he asked for, and the second battle opened. At its beginning, steam down, guns unloaded, not a single Federal vessel was prepared for action. But this was presently so thoroughly corrected that Brown could later say, "I had the most lively realization of having steamed into a real volcano." Guns were flashing, and as he advanced, the line of fire seemed to grow into a circle, constantly closing. Even so, he saw one definite advantage to fighting solo from an interior position, and the Arkansas was not neglectful of it. Firing rapidly to every point of the circumference without the fear of hitting a friend or missing an enemy. Now, though, she was taking about as much punishment as she gave. The big ocean-going sloops had run their guns out, and the Davis ironclads were firing for all they were worth. The Arkansas took hits from all directions. An 11-inch solid broke through her casemate armor and laid a 16-man gun crew dead and dying on her deck. A rifle bolt laid out 11 more. Shrapnel quickly gave her stack the look of a nutmeg grater, so that, for lack of draft, the pressure dropped from 120 pounds to 20, barely enough to turn the engines. The temperature in the fire room soared to 130 degrees, and the engineers worked 15-minute shifts, by the end of which they had to be hauled up, half-roasted, and relieved by men from the guns. 60 dead and wounded men were in her. Her cast-iron snout was broken off. One whole section of plating was ripped from her flank. Her boats were shot away and dragging. However, she still was giving as good as she got, or better. Out on the shield, where he had had his spyglass shot from his hands, Her captain had never stopped calling orders to the pilot house and guns. A ram broke into the clear at last, driving hard in a final effort to block the way. "Go through him, Brady!" Brown shouted. But one of the bow guns averted the need for a collision by putting a shell through the Federal's boiler. Steam went up like a geyser, and the Blue Jacket crew went overboard. That was the final round. The Arkansas was into the clear, past the outer rim of the volcano. Limping badly but unpursued, she held her course for Vicksburg, where a crowd had assembled on the bluff to greet her. Soldiers and townspeople alike, they tossed their hats in joy and admiration. But the cheers froze in their throats when they looked down and saw the carnage on her gun deck. Farragut was infuriated. He had been sleeping late that morning, and when the cannonade erupted, he appeared on the Hartford's deck in his nightshirt. However, the flagship's engines were under repair. There was nothing he could do but watch and fire at the strange vessel as it went by. When the action was over, he surveyed the wreckage, which was not only considerable but was largely self-inflicted by crossfire, then returned to his cabin, muttering as he went, "Damnable neglect, or worse, somewhere." The more he thought about it, the madder he got. By the time he came back on deck again, fully dressed, he had made up his mind to steam down to Vicksburg with all his ships and attack the Arkansas in broad open daylight, hillside batteries and all. His staff managed to dissuade him from this, at least give the fleet captains time to wash the blood from their scuppers, they said. But even so, the old man would not be put off any longer than nightfall. Porter's mortar schooners, together with the Brooklyn and the two laggard gunboats, were still below the city, where the apparently unsinkable rebel ironclad might engage them any minute. He ordered all guns loaded with solid and suspended his heaviest anchor from the tip of the Hartford's port main yardarm, intending to drop it through the Arkansas's deck and bottom when he got alongside her. The Davis gunboats and the Porter mortars would give covering fire above and below while he went in and dragged the upstart monster from its lair. Just before sunset, he hoisted the familiar pennant for attack, and the fleet moved downriver. It did not work out at all the way he intended. For one thing, in the ruddy murk between sunset and dusk, the rust-red boat was almost invisible under the red clay bank. The first each skipper saw of her as the ships came past in single file, taking in turn a pounding from the batteries overhead, was the flash of her guns as he crossed her line of fire. By then it was too late to attempt to check up and grapple. All there was time for was one quick broadside in reply before the current swept him out of range. Aboard the Arkansas, dismay at having to fight the day's third battle, tied to bank and with less than half her crew still functional, gave way to elation as the action progressed. One by one the ships glided past with their towering spars in silhouette against the glow of the western cloud bank, and one by one they took them under fire as if in a gigantic shooting gallery. But when the Hartford stood in close, groping blindly with the anchor swaying pendulous from her yardarm, and they loosed a broadside at her, she thundered back with a tremendous salvo. An 11-inch solid pierced the side of the Arkansas just above the waterline, crashed through the engine room, killing and mangling as it went, and lodged in the opposite casemate armor, making what one of her officers called a bulging protuberance outside. She kept firing until the river stopped sending her targets. Then once more there was silence. Farragut was where he wanted to be, south of the infernal bluff, and he had made the downstream run with fewer casualties than before. 5 killed, 16 wounded, only a handful more than his adversary had suffered. But he was far from satisfied. He wanted that ram, and he intended to have her, whatever the cost. At daylight, he sent an urgent message to Davis, proposing that both fleets go in together at high noon and fight the rebel to a finish. Davis declined the invitation, counseling prudence and self-control. "I have watched 8 rams for a month," he replied, "and now find it no hard task to watch one." He continued to resist the pressure which Farragut kept applying. 5 days later, July 21st, the Arkansas, having ventured out meanwhile on a sortie that was aborted by another engine failure, he agreed to make an attempt next morning with the ironclad Essex and the Queen of the West. The plan was for the gunboat to shove the rebel vessel hard against bank and hold her there, sitting duck fashion so that the ram could butt a hole in her side and send her to the bottom. But this did not work either. Brown had the Arkansas moored with her head upstream, and when he saw the Essex coming at him, he slacked his bowline and presented his sharp armored prow to the blunt-nosed gunboat, which swerved at the last minute to avoid being sliced in two, taking and giving punishment as she passed. The Queen, following close behind, anxious to redeem her performance up the Yazoo the week before, could manage no more than a glancing blow. She worked her way back upstream, rejoining Davis, but the Essex went with the current, her engines badly shot up in the melee, and joined the fleet below. Farragut threw up his hands at this. Fuel was low, and what with the need for keeping up steam in case the Arkansas staged another sudden appearance, was getting considerably lower every day. Sanitation was also a problem, as Halleck had foreseen. The swampy Mississippi heat had nearly half of Farragut's sailors on the sick list, along with 3/4 of the canal-digging soldiers. The falling river seemed about to make good its threat to strand him up here, out of circulation for the rest of the year. Besides, a message from Wells, sent before the secretary learned of the rebel ram's emergence, had just arrived. "Go down the river at discretion." That was what Farragut did, and he did it without delay. Starting south on July 26th, he dropped the orphaned Essex and 2 of the smaller wooden gunboats off at Baton Rouge, along with Williams's shovel-weary soldiers, and put into New Orleans for repairs that would fit the rest of his saltwater ships for more agreeable blockade duty along the Gulf. Back in his native element at last, able to breathe all the way to the depths of his lungs, he said goodbye to the Mississippi. Forever, he hoped. Davis pulled out northward that same day, transferring his base to Helena, 200 miles upstream. Vicksburg was delivered, along with a great stretch of the river between Napoleon and Natchez. Wells was extremely angry when he heard the news. He told Farragut, "It is an absolute necessity that the neglect or apparent neglect of the squadron should be wiped out by the destruction of the Arkansas." Nothing came of this as far as Farragut was concerned. He was downstream and he stayed there. But it was an event that rankled in the secretary's memory ever after, worse than Donelson, worse than Hampton Roads, worse even than Head of the Passes or Plum Run Bend. Bitter and chagrined, Wells later wrote, "The most disreputable naval affair of the war was the descent of the steam ram Arkansas through both squadrons until she hauled into the batteries of Vicksburg, and there the 2 flag officers abandoned the place and the ironclad ram, Farragut and his force going down to New Orleans, and Davis proceeding with his flotilla up the river." On Vicksburg's bluff, conversely, there was rejoicing and there was pride, not only because the naval siege had been raised, but also because of the manner in which the feat had been accomplished. The combined might of 2 victorious Union fleets had been challenged, sundered, and repulsed by a single homemade 10-gun ironclad, backed by the industry and daring of her builder and commander. Coming as it did after a season of reverses, this exploit gave the people of the lower Mississippi Valley a new sense of confidence and elation. They were glad to be alive in a time when such things could happen, and they asked themselves how a nation could ever be conquered when its destiny rested with men like those who served aboard the Arkansas under Isaac Newton Brown. In the Trans-Mississippi, too, there was the discomfort of indigestion, proceeding from a difficulty in assimilating all that had been gained. Sam Curtis was glad to have the Davis Rams and gunboats with him, almost as glad as he had been to receive the division from Grant, which reached Helena the week before and brought his total strength to 18,000. This was the largest force he had yet commanded, half again larger than the army with which he had won the Battle of Pea Ridge. But as he saw it, he had need of every man and gun he could get ashore or afloat. Looking back on that savage conflict, which involved the repulse of a slashing double envelopment by Price and McCulloch, with Van Dorn hovering wild-eyed in the background and swarms of painted Indians on his flank, he perceived 100 things that might have spelled defeat if they had gone against instead of for him. It seemed to him now in late July that events were building up to another such encounter, in which the scales, balanced against him, he believed, as they had been in early March, might tip the other way. For a time it had been otherwise. Through April and May he had occupied a vacuum, so to speak. Van Dorn and Price had crossed the Mississippi and left Arkansas to him. On the final day of May, however, this leisure season ended with the Confederate appointment of Major General Thomas C. Hindman, a Helena lawyer and congressman who had led a division at Shiloh, to command the area, including Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana south to the Red, and Indian Territory. A dapper little man, just over 5 feet tall, addicted to ruffled shirts and patent leather boots, Hindman, like his predecessor, Earl Van Dorn, made up in activity for what he lacked in size. He had need of all his energy now. The situation on his arrival was about as bad as it could be, the scarcity of volunteers lending support to the post-war tall tale that the entire state of Montana was afterwards populated by rebel fugitives from Elkhorn Tavern. But he went immediately to work, issuing fiery proclamations and enforcing the new conscription law in his native state with troops brought from Texas. Lacking arms and munitions, he set up factories and chemical works to turn them out, operated lead mines and tan yards, and even organized the women of his department into sewing circles to furnish uniforms for all the able-bodied men he could lay hands on. Word of his activity soon spread, and recruits began to trickle in from Missouri, some of whom he sent back home with orders to raise guerrilla bands to harass the invaders' rear. Before long, Curtis was receiving intelligence reports that put the Confederate strength in Midland, Arkansas, at 25,000 men. His plan had been to march on Little Rock as soon as his army had recovered from its exertions, thus adding to the southern list of fallen capitals, but the presence of Hindman's newborn army in that direction changed his mind. Instead, after much conferring back and forth with Washington, he moved toward Helena for a possible share in the amphibious descent of the Mississippi. Even that was hard enough. All through June, bridge burners and irregular cavalrymen, instructed by Hindman to bushwhack Union pickets, destroy all food and pollute the water, by killing cattle, ripping the carcasses open and throwing them in, harassed his line of march and kept him in almost constant expectation of being swamped by overwhelming numbers. At last he reached the Big River, only to find that the descent had been called off. Halleck was busy consolidating his gains. It was just as well as far as Curtis was concerned. He began to fortify his Helena position, not knowing what all-out mischief Hindman might be plotting in the brush. Even after the arrival of the division from Memphis and the ironclads from Vicksburg, together with siege guns brought downriver from Bird's Point, Columbus, and Fort Pillow, he felt far from easy about his situation. Not only was there danger in front, he now learned of a new danger in his rear. The Missourians, who had gone back home with instructions for making trouble, were showing a good deal of talent for such work. Brigadier General John M. Schofield, the federal commander there, reported that he had discovered a well-devised scheme for a monster guerrilla outbreak involving 30,000 to 50,000 men who were assembling now at designated places to await the appointed signal, and, by a sudden coup de main, seize the important points in the state, surprise and capture our small detachments guarding railroads, etc., thus securing arms and ammunition, and cooperate with an invading army from Arkansas. He called on Curtis to deal with this invasion force, which had moved into the vacated area around Pea Ridge, while he did his best to deal with the guerrillas. "You are aware, General, that I have no force sufficient to drive them back without your assistance," he implored. "Let me ask you to act as quickly as possible." Curtis could not help him. If it came to the worst, he wasn't even sure he could help himself. He had all sorts of troubles. As a result of trying to encourage trade in cotton, he said, his camp was infested with Jews, secessionists, and spies. Then, too, his health was failing, or, as he put it, "I am not exactly well." At any rate, whatever rebel hosts were gathering in northwest Arkansas, the last thing he intended was a retracing of his steps on the harried march he had just completed. All he could do was hold what he had, probing occasionally at the country roundabout as the long hot summer wore on toward a close. Schofield's fears for Missouri were soon fulfilled, though in a less concerted fashion than he had predicted. No less than 80 skirmishes were fought there during July and August, including one that resulted in the capture of Independence by guerrillas under Charles Quantrill, who presently was commissioned a Confederate captain as a reward for this exploit. Kansas, too, was threatened. Jim Lane, the grim Jayhawk chieftain, was raising Negro troops. Zouave d'Afrique, they were called, for they drilled in baggy scarlet pantaloons Stanton had purchased in the emergency from France. North of there, in the absence of soldiers transferred south and east, the Minnesota Sioux went on the warpath, massacring settlers by the hundreds. Everywhere Curtis looked, he saw trouble, though most of it was fortunately well beyond his reach at Helena. Remaining in the fine big house on a hill overlooking the river, it was Hindman's, or it had been, Curtis had taken it for his headquarters, he improved his fortifications, put his trust in the Mississippi as a supply line, and shook his head disapprovingly at the chaos all around him. "Society is terribly mutilated," he reported. At the opposite end of the western line, Buell was moving eastward. Or he had been, anyhow. Until he encountered troubles he would gladly have swapped for those of Curtis and Grant combined, with Schofield's thrown in for good measure. As it turned out, he not only had supply and guerrilla problems as acute as theirs. Presently it became obvious, too, that his was the column that was to receive the main attention of the main Confederate army in the West, beginning with the twin thunderbolts, Morgan and Forrest, who were thrown at him soon after he got started. In giving him instructions for the eastward move, 10 days after the fall of Corinth, Halleck was heeding the repeated suggestion of Ormsby Mitchell, who for a month had been signaling frantically that he could see the end of the war from where he stood in northeast Alabama. If he were reinforced, he said, he could march straight into Chattanooga, then turn south and take Atlanta. From there, he added, the way lay open to Richmond's back door, through a region that was completely unprotected and very much alarmed. Old Brains could see merit in this, and he also saw a possible variation. Knoxville, too, lay beyond that mountain gateway, an objective he knew was dear to the heart of Lincoln, who was anxious to disenthrall the pro-Union citizens of East Tennessee and gain control of the railroad connecting Virginia and North Georgia. Accordingly, Halleck gave Buell his instructions on June 9th for a lateral offensive, the only one of any kind that he intended to launch in the West this summer, simultaneously notifying Washington of the intended movement, and 2 days later received the expected reply. Lincoln was greatly delighted. The extent of the president's delight was shown before the month was out. Alarmed by Lee's assault on McClellan, who was crying for reinforcements as he fell back, the War Department called on the Western commander for 25,000 troops to be shifted to the east. But when Halleck replied that to send them would mean that the Chattanooga expedition would have to be abandoned or at least be diminished, the reaction was immediate and negative, and it came in the form of a telegram from Lincoln himself. "This must not be done on any account," he said. To take and hold the railroad at or east of Cleveland in East Tennessee, I think fully as important as the taking and holding of Richmond. By that time, Buell was well on his way. He had by no means reached Cleveland, a junction 30 miles beyond his immediate objective, where the railroad coming down from Knoxville branched west to Chattanooga and south to Atlanta. But he had advanced his 4 divisions to Huntsville, having ferried the Tennessee River at Florence, and had repaired the Memphis and Charleston line as far east as Decatur. He had about 35,000 men in his present column, including cavalry and engineers, and Mitchell was waiting up ahead with 11,000 more. Off to the north, ready to cooperate as soon as Knoxville became the goal, George Morgan occupied Cumberland Gap with a division of 9,000, which was also a component of Buell's Army of the Ohio. In addition to these 55,000 troops, Thomas was at Iuka, awaiting orders to march east with his own division of 8,000, plus 2 from Grant, which had been promised in case they were required. Just now, however, Buell did not want them. He was having trouble enough feeding the men he had, and the problem got progressively worse as he moved eastward, lengthening his supply line. The 300 tons of food and forage needed daily, 3.25 pounds for a man, 26 for a horse, 23 for a mule, were more than the guerrilla-harried railroads could supply. Besides a shortage of rolling stock, destruction of the Elk River Bridge on the Nashville-Decatur line necessitated a 40-mile wagon haul around the break, and sniper fire was so frequent and effective that ironclad boxcars had to be provided for the protection of the train crews. Buell put his men and animals on half rations, much to the discomfort of both. "We are living from day to day on short supplies, and our operations are completely crippled," he complained to the Louisville quartermaster. Ahead, he knew, lay additional problems. The river crossing at Bridgeport, for example. Retiring from in front of Chattanooga the month before, Mitchell had burned the mile-long span, and Buell had no material with which to build another. In an attempt to fill the shortage and make amends, Mitchell ordered all the sawmills between Huntsville and Stevenson put to work supplying lumber for pontoons and a bridge floor. But this, too, was an occasion for guerrilla interference, causing the workers to run away for fear of being murdered on the job or in their beds. All in all, the prospect was grim. Buell's chief solace was the knowledge that he was doing the best he could with what he had, and his chief hope was that his industry was appreciated by those above him. The latter was dispelled by an alarming and discouraging message from Halleck, July 8th. The alarm came first. Bragg's army was reported to be in motion, either against Grant at Memphis or Corinth, or against Buell at Tuscumbia or Chattanooga. "A few days more may reduce these doubts to a certainty when our troops will operate accordingly," Halleck reported, unruffled. Then came the discouragement. "The president telegraphs that your progress is not satisfactory and that you should move more rapidly. The long time taken by you to reach Chattanooga will enable the enemy to anticipate you by concentrating a large force to meet you. I communicate his views, hoping that your movements hereafter may be so rapid as to remove all cause of complaint, whether well-founded or not." Buell later declared, "I was so astonished at the message that I made no reply until 3 days afterward." What jogged him then was a 6-word dispatch. "I want to hear from you, H.W. Halleck." In reply, Buell reviewed his difficulties, remarking as he did so, "I regret that it is necessary to explain the circumstances which must make my progress seem so slow." As he saw it, the object was not only to reach his goal quickly, but also to be in condition to fight when he got there. "The advance on Chattanooga must be made with the means of acting in force, otherwise it will either fail, as Mitchell's had done, or else the city would provide a profitless and transient prize." His arrangements, made in accordance with this, were being pushed forward as rapidly as possible, And though he quite understood that these are matters of fact that cannot be gratifying, he added, the dissatisfaction of the president pains me exceedingly. Next day, Halleck responded with assurances of personal goodwill. He could see both sides of the question, and he urged Buell to be more tolerant of the amateurs above them. I can well understand the difficulties you have to encounter, and also the impatience at Washington. In the first place, they have no conception of the length of our lines of defense and of operations. In the second place, the disasters before Richmond have worked them up to boiling heat. At any rate, he assured him, I will see that your movements are properly explained to the president. This was helpful in relieving the pain, lately added to by John Morgan, who had led his gray raiders up through Middle Tennessee, and was capturing railroad guards, burning bridges, and smashing culverts in Kentucky. But still more comforting to Buell was the fact that his advance was now past Stevenson, where the Nashville and Chattanooga, coming down through Murfreesboro and Tullahoma, joined the Memphis and Charleston, thus affording him an additional rail supply line. Anticipating this, he had work gangs all along the road, repairing the damage done by retreating Confederates, and to make certain that it was not wrecked again, either by raiders or guerrillas, he had stationed a brigade at Murfreesboro, two regiments of infantry, a cavalry detachment, and a four-gun battery, ready to move out in either direction at the first sign of trouble. On June 12th, the date of Halleck's sympathetic message, Buell was informed that the repairs had been completed. The first trainload of supplies would leave Nashville tomorrow or the next day. He would be able to take his soldiers off half rations and replace their worn-out shoes as soon as it got there. What got there tomorrow, however, was not a trainload of supplies, but rather